Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. The fighting near Fallujah remains the focus of the war in Iraq this morning. There are reports that insurgents have shot down a second U.S. helicopter, and fighting is reported to be heavy in the land between Fallujah and Baghdad. The latest word from the U.S. military is that more than 70 coalition soldiers have been killed in the last 2 weeks. More than 700 Iraqis are reported dead. And it's that latter figure that's now transforming Fallujah into something of a rallying cry for those opposed to the U.S. occupation. Once again, they say, it proves that America's not there to set them free, but to rule them. And so it begs the question, where are the moderate Iraqis? Where are the voices of those who still welcome the capture of Saddam Hussein and believe in a democratic future? This hour, and we invite you to join us, we will ask, who does speak for Iraq? Do you think that the Iraqi Governing Council, the men and women selected by the American-led coalition to lead Iraq after the handover, do you think they'll be ready to take charge in 79 days? Or does the Iraqi Governing Council lack the power and popular support to do so? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll start the program today in our Boston studio with Zainab Al-Suwayd. She is Executive Director of the American Islamic Congress. 13 years ago, Zainab took part in the failed uprising against Saddam Hussein, just back from 10-month stay in Iraq. And nice to have you back in our studio.
Thank you.
And joining us on the line from Istanbul, Hassan Fatah, former editor of Iraq Today. Hassan, it's nice to hear your voice again, or nice to have you with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, Hassan, the last time you and I spoke, you were running Iraq Today in Baghdad. Tell us why you're in Istanbul this morning.
Well, quite simply, actually, I left about 2 weeks ago, and they're under significant threat. There have been a lot of issues that we've had to deal with. I had a very close friend who was killed, and there was enough indication that I was next on the list. It's part of the daily life of Iraqis, and unfortunately, even journalists are now being targeted as well.
And was there no protection available, given the threats that were coming into Iraq Today, even 3, 4, 5 months ago?
The question is, who do you turn to, and who can you rely on in a situation like that? I think that's the fundamental problem for almost every Iraqi. For many, you turn to your tribe or your tribal leader who tries to protect you or tries to muscle his way through things. But for many others, there's simply nothing you can do but sit and wait or just stay away from the streets or try to lay low.
Now, Hassan, you went back to Iraq after years of living abroad, Beirut, Jordan, also California. So, I mean, you've got this kind of global perspective on what it is that the coalition says it's trying to do and what it is the coalition is doing and how that's being received. Tell me, as you sit in Turkey, whether or not you think you're going to be going back to Iraq in a week or a month. What are you thinking?
Well, I left for 2 weeks thinking I was going to go for 2 weeks and come back. But it's becoming much, much harder to go back with each moving day. In fact, physically getting there sounds like it's becoming the most dangerous part, with several journalists and a whole slew of people being taken hostage along the way. Unfortunately, I mean, in some ways, this is not so surprising. Many people were predicting things getting much hotter, far more dangerous. I think that nobody expected them to get to this hot and this dangerous.
Stay with me for a minute, if you will, Hassan. I'd like to talk for a couple of seconds with Zainab Al-Suwayd, who's here with me in the studio. And you also bring a long perspective and an American understanding to this particular issue. Zainab, you came back from Iraq just a week or so ago. Were you among those leaving because it was getting too hot?
Actually, the work that I've been doing in Iraq is almost finished back there, so it's about time for me to leave.
But a good time to leave as well.
That's right. And by the time I was leaving the country, things started accelerating. And all along the past 10 months, the situation has not been really very stable in terms of security. Sometimes things accelerate more than what it having like on a daily basis. So things have been changing every now and then. Depends on the political situation inside Iraq.
Born and raised in southern Iraq, left when you were a teenager, but you've been back there now for almost a year, 10 months in
That's
Iraq.
That's right.
And I guess you were, the last time we talked, you were so much in support of the American invasion of Iraq, the decision to try and take down Saddam Hussein.
That's right.
Tell me, looking at it now, after 10 months of seeing the turmoil in that country and looking at it from the perspective now, are you still every bit as in favor of the invasion?
Well, I'm in favor of getting rid of Saddam and his regime. And that happened last year, and which we're, most of the Iraqis are thankful for. The situation in Iraq has not been really in a good side, that we say, but things are improving much better than early last year, immediately after the collapse of the regime.
Well, the news would indicate otherwise, that the uprising in Fallujah, the attack of the Americans there, that's providing some kind of rallying case for the people who want America out. I'd say things are doesn't look like that's improving anyway.
Well, these things are there, true, but at the same time, there is the other side of the Iraqi life. I see that media intend always to concentrate on the turmoil and all the problems, not concentrating on how, for example, the economy is doing very well in Iraq, and how people are happy that Saddam no longer existing there. On the other side, yes, there is a lot of and pleasant event that's happening, and a lot of, as we say, uprising here and there. But these people, don't forget, these people, they have been in favor during Saddam's regime, and they do have a lot of privileges during that time. And right now they lost all of that, so they have to fight a little bit to gain something back if they wish.
Hassan Fatah, bring your journalistic eye to this for me, if you will. I mean, we often hear that there's a fascination with everything, every place where the bullets are being fired, and a complete ignorance of what's going on elsewhere in the country. Do you think that the attention in Fallujah is missing a bigger story in Iraq?
I should say, as a newspaper editor in Iraq, I'm lucky that I got to do all the stories that would be considered boring. The so-called inside baseball that actually tells you far deeper pieces of the story. I think one of the problems with how this is being looked at, it is either Saddam and this, or, I'm sorry, getting rid of Saddam and this, or having Saddam. And I think that's part of the problem. I don't think anybody is hoping or wishing for Saddam to return, really. Even the people who are former Saddam loyalists are probably fighting for their own power base more than they are for Saddam himself. And I think that far too often, framing the issue in a matter of, why don't they appreciate that we got rid of Saddam, really misses the point. The point is about the kind of decisions and the kind of things that have been made in this occupation. A lot of things that simply don't need to be happening. That said, Iraq is really a good news and a bad news story. And what makes it such a hard story to tell is that the good news is getting better and the bad news is getting worse, much worse. So that for the average Iraqi, in some ways, his standard of living is improving slowly but surely. He can go out and say anything he wants in the middle of the street. He has a certain degree of freedom that I don't think any Iraqi would give up. At the same time, there's an occupation. There's foreign troops on the soil who don't speak their language and don't understand who they are, and vice versa. I don't think anybody will ever accept a foreign soldier on his own land telling him what to do, much less many of the other kinds of things that have happened over the past year that have made this whole situation so much more complicated and so much more difficult. Where we are today, 1 year on, is that the problems we're suffering from are just so difficult to solve because they've run on for an entire year.
Zainab, does that mean that, in your view, the idea of handing power from the Americans to some Iraqi governing council or whatever it is going to have to wait? It can't happen by the end of June?
I think it's have to wait. I think end of June is too soon to have that happen, or to giving sovereignty to Iraqis. people need to understand, people need to be trained, people need to know what this upcoming period is going to be and how it's going to bring.
So when would it be? 6 months from now? Another year from now? What do you think?
Whenever the country is ready.
But the reason the question is being asked now is that, you know, so much has gone back. We were talking just before the program about government offices in southern Iraq in places like Najaf and Karbala, where the bandits basically moved in and stripped the plumbing and looted the place like they did 1 year ago.
That's right.
I mean, we could be sitting here a year from now saying, well, soon the Iraqi Governing Council will have power. I just don't know where you think it might turn, where they might actually gain that power.
Well, they can gain that power when, as I said, when people are ready and they are trained to have the government to Iraqi the full power. We have so many people in the street, for example, they do not understand what's going to happen, how the power is going to be handed in to Iraqis, who's going to take that power, who will participate in the new government. There are a lot of ambiguity among the Iraqi people. These things need to be explained to people. These things need to be spread or talk about it in the media and the news and publishing newspapers and all of these things. So people, I think, need to understand the upcoming period that they are facing.
Hassan Fatah, how long do you think it will be before there'll be any real political power held by Iraqis?
Well, I think the problem with the whole framing is time rather than milestones. And I think that's the real problem with June 30th. We shouldn't really be talking about how long, but really at what stage. When will the Iraqi Governing Council or some form of government or some form of authority be able to take over? I think that in some ways there are a lot of ways in which the Governing Council or whatever other authority can take its place, is ready for some form of authority. And I think that the word power is also is part of the problem, because it shouldn't be about power, but it should be about authority, about responsibility. And I think that that's what's missing for a lot of the Governing Council members. There's none of the usual things you would expect from a leader, which is accountability, transparency, a role or log of the kind of decisions and votes they've made and all these sorts of things that we've been hoping for. I don't necessarily think it's infinitely far away. I think that we're in a problem now where we've pushed the June 30th deadline so far that we are going to get into big trouble if we go back on it.
Hassan, I have to stop you there. I want to thank you for being with us on the program today, and I hope you get a chance to go back to Baghdad at some point soon.
Hassan, I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Hassan Fatah, editor of Iraq Today, joining us there on the line from Istanbul, Turkey. Now, our telephone number, Connection listeners, is 1-800-423-8255. You could call it authority or power or responsibility or accountability, but people on this side of the ocean and people in that country have very different ideas about the shift of power from America to Iraq, how quickly it can happen, and what needs to be in place. We'd like to hear from you. As I said, our number is 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Zainab Al-Suwayj is here with me in the studio. She is Executive Director of the American Islamic Congress, just back last Tuesday from a 10-month stint in Iraq. This hour we're talking about that ever-elusive transfer of power from the U.S. to Iraqi authorities, and we'd like to have you with us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And Zainab, can we make it simple? Can we just ask, who's at fault here? Because when you talk about this transfer of power, the Iraqis say, well, the Americans won't give us any responsibility. It's not our fault. And you talk to the Americans, and the Americans say, well, they don't take any responsibility. It's their fault. Who's really at fault here?
Well, we cannot blame one or another.
Oh,
but
come on now, be tough here.
But look, it's between the two, actually. The American, the CPA or the American government should give more responsibility or more authority to Iraqi Governing Council. And because they know how to, these council members, they know how to, like, the way they understand their culture, the people's culture, and what's going on inside the country and how the best way to treat to deal with the people back there in Iraq. Now, the governing council members have to reach out to the Iraqi community, to the Iraqi people, explain to them.
They're living under death threats.
That's true, but also there are many ways that you can reach to the people through media, through events. There are some areas that have been secured,
right,
and meet with people, have events that invite 200, 500, 300 people into a hall and have a meeting with them, explain to them about the upcoming period of time and the legitimacy of having the government business transferred to Iraqis and what's going to happen. All of these things, Iraqis, most of the Iraqis right now are living in an ambiguous period
fear.
Of and fear at the same time. And they would like to know... what's that governing council? They would like to know the people who are representing them as a government. And right now, this connection is missing. So I think they should work more and harder. The Iraqi governing council should more and harder on reaching out to the Iraqi people.
Let's swing over to our callers. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll take our first call from Michael, who's joining us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Dick, you're beginning to get into the meat of the issue. All the American press so far has been focusing too much on this issue of the date, June 30th, can we transfer sovereignty?
Okay.
And you are beginning to talk about power, which is one step more concrete than sovereignty, but it's all a myth. First off, let's talk about democracy. The U.S. talks about wanting democracy in the Middle East, but in fact, that's the last thing this government wants. We want governments which will follow our direction, our lead, our influence. And if we get real democracies, we tend to push them around or overthrow them. Look at Iran 50 years ago. Look at Guatemala. Look at the effort to overthrow Venezuela in Chile. The whole history of the last 50 years is of U.S. government not supporting democracies in the developing world.
And often in those cases, Michael, using the excuse that the battle against communism would have to come ahead of that. I guess I want to try and zero in right on where you began here in terms of defining sovereignty and power, because it really comes down to, in many ways, who controls the security of the country. That's really going to be the measure, isn't it, Michael?
Exactly. And I have read, I hope I've read mistakenly in the papers, that the U.S. has already announced that after the transfer of, quote, sovereignty, any Iraqi military forces will continue to report to and be under the control of the U.S. military. Now, I think that's correct because I've read it in several places, and if General Bremer or one of the other U.S. generals is in control of the absurdly poorly trained, badly recruited and terrified Iraqi military forces, in what sense would we have transferred sovereignty, whether it's June 30th or a year from June 30th? It's a fraud.
Zainab, is there any definition that Iraqis, people that you were working with and people you met in Baghdad, use for what that real power would be? This idea of June 30th, I think Michael is agreeing with you that you can't just put an X on a day on the calendar and say, there, you'll
That's
have
right.
sovereignty at that point. So how will Iraqis define sovereignty?
Well, Iraqis would like to see, first of all, a secure country. Security is missing there. And most of them, they think that by June 30th, when Iraq is going to have sovereignty, it's going to be a big mess because the country is not ready. I heard this from so many people inside Iraq, and they are very scared that June 30th will come, and then so many different powers inside Iraq, whether political powers or opposition powers, will will fight among each other and will end up in civil war inside Iraq. This is the big fear.
Let's, if we can, agree with the other thrust of Michael's question, mm-hmm. and that is my own experience mm-hmm. there. You have a lot more than I do. Is that the Iraqis believe June 30th has more to do with the American presidential election calendar than it has to do with their own well-being. Many Iraqis are very suspicious about American interest in their oil. Many Iraqis feel, as Michael does, that mm-hmm. there's never really going to be any transfer of power. This is getting to my way of thinking. Mm-hmm. More and more Iraqis are beginning to believe this. And this is real trouble for the Americans, isn't it?
As I said, Iraqis has a lot of what you just mentioned in their mind. Yes, that's true. But at the same time, they are they fear that there's no the ambiguity of what's happening after June 30th is making them scared more than what they are right now. All of these previous reasons that you just mentioned are yes in their mind, but at the same time they are looking at on day to day life, how life is going to resume, and how all of these things is going to be continuing in daily basis. They do not understand. The simple people in the street, they do not understand what's this mean, whether giving servant to Iraqis or having America controlling everything there. But what they do want is to live normal life and secure life. Some of them, they don't care, really.
But part of the problem has to be, though, Zainab, that these people you refer to as the simple people on the street, these are the ones who are jumping in the backs of trucks and mm-hmm. saying, we're going off to Fallujah. It's jihad time. While there is no voice offering mm-hmm. them any other kind of future, mm-hmm. there are plenty of voices encouraging them to fight the occupiers.
Well, that's not true in every region in Iraq.
That's a good point.
And these are some few people that I think the media has been focusing a lot on. And there are many people, they just like to live a normal life inside Iraq. They had it enough with so many wars before during Saddam time. And right now is for them time to being stable, to build a new life and to go on with their life and family and work.
And why don't those people speak up? Why don't those people say, you know, enough with the insurgents, enough with mm-hmm. the people who are advocating a war. We are Iraqis who want peace.
Well, these people are many of them are speaking out, but no one is focusing on them. Media would not focus on somebody who would like to have a peace, but will focus on people who are in a rubble.
Within the Iraqi mm-hmm. political sphere, there aren't 10,000 people mm-hmm. in the squares demonstrating mm-hmm. against the insurgents. You know, I mean, let's be honest about this.
That's right, but don't forget the security situation inside Iraq is not the best. I mean, security situation is stopping so many people from doing many things, and sometimes stopping people from going to their work and kids going to school and stuff like that. So if you have a secure country with a total security inside Iraq, and that will be much easier for people to do.
Let's take a call from Northampton, Massachusetts. Alan's joining us on the line. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest what's happening with voter registration in Iraq.
Census, voter registration, any of that going on?
I don't think anything is going on right now, as far as I know. People are, there are a lot of organizations and initiatives would like to introduce this concept to Iraqi people and on how to elect and how to do. But right now is just has been talking more than doing anything. And
Alan, it's an interesting question. I wonder why you use voter registration as a way of marking progress there.
Simply because you can't have a democracy unless you've got people to elect them.
Well, people need to know about what democracy is first. Many people, they know the word, but they do not really know what it means. I always say they people back there, they need to learn more about democracy and what it is, just basically giving them 101 democracy class before jumping into election and all of these things that people are not aware of. During Saddam time, they used to elect, but there is only one person to elect, and that was it. So right now, it's I think the tax is much more bigger, and people need to focus on how to choose their candidates and how who will be eligible to run for election.
Well, was there a registration system under the old regime?
Well, there's no. I believe during that time, each person can go to a closest school or registration office there, and they can go on and vote. But the
that
vote
system
was
not trusting. It's
not trusting, of course. And there's only one person to elect, and they don't really count or do any of these censuses. I mean, because it's only goes for one person, and so what kind of election is that?
Alan, just a last one from you, if you're still there, and that is, as you watch what's going on there, do you have any sense that there's going to be the ability for the Americans to back off, give some control to the Iraqis?
Well, if there's going to be a democratic government there, you have to have an election. I would think that would be one of the things you'd be focusing on.
And you got to have people to vote for. You're right. It's a great point. And it's one of the things that certainly the Iraqi Governing Council has been struggling towards. Alan, thanks a lot for your call. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going next to Concord, Massachusetts, and Mike's with us. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to get back to the whole question of sovereignty. As opposed to more than a word. And I just had a little observation. Recently, the governing council worked on a constitution. And they worked and they worked and they worked. And when it got all done, the Shiite members had a problem with it. Now, the solution to this was that what we heard in the news, I mean, I'm an American, not an Iraqi, but what we heard in the news was that Paul Bremer hit the roof. And arms were twisted, and things happened, and suddenly, you know, the Shiite members voted to approve the Constitution as it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a couple months later, we have a Shiite insurrection, and everybody's surprised, and I don't understand. Does everybody sleep here? I mean, anybody paying attention? This is what sovereignty is about, right?
Mike, let's just... Hang on for half a sec, because I want to check with Zainab on this whole constitution issue. I think you've done a good job of describing how those days were seen here in America. How about in Baghdad? You were there at the time.
Actually, there was a lot of
arm twisting,
struggle among the governing council members and CPA around that time to talk about or discuss the constitution. At the end of it, actually, I was that time I came to the state for a couple of weeks, and then I went back.
Then let me put the question to you in another way. Do the Iraqis even know that they have a constitution? Do they even know what's in the constitution?
They know that they do have a constitution, and some of them, they don't know. Many of them, actually, they don't know what's in that constitution.
Can I interject here?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, when you say do Iraqis even know, I mean... most countries that I'm familiar with, there's a large mass of the population that is not intimately connected with the governing process. I mean, I'm an elected official, albeit a small, you know, local one, but most people are not that involved. But they take their cues from their leaders, and their leaders are,
that's
I'm
right,
certain, clear that they have a constitution.
That's true. What you're saying is true, that most of the people back there, they take their words from their leaders, whether spiritual leaders or political leaders, and they follow. And that's what happened when the Constitution was passed and everyone signed on it, and then some of the Shia leaders, they said no, or they back up, and then they went and discussed with Ayatollah Sistani about the objection about the constitution. Then what happened they agreed, or they had discussion and agreed some on some of the thing that they were disagreed on before, and end up passing that constitution. Even though still there are many groups people are disagreeing with the constitution.
That's all right. A lot of people in this country disagree mm-hmm. with the constitution as well, and they still live by it. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us this hour. Let's go next to Boston, and Roxana's on the line. Hi, Roxana.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot for taking my call. I agree 100% with Zina that the Iraqis have no idea what democracy is. Coming from a communist country, I know that there is absolutely no clue what democracy really is. And after the fall of communism in 89, BBC was running a so-called Marshall Plan for Democracy. They were organizing theater sketches over the radio, teaching the people what democracy is, how to elect, what the vote is, what the constitution is.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any intention of teaching those people as they go in the back of the truck and they go to Fallujah? Do you have any intention of teaching them what democracy is?
Roxana,
I think people like Mr. Hassan Fattah that stays comfortable in Istanbul and complains of the occupation, he should go back and teach the people what democracy is.
Hassan Fattah, in his credit, because he's not here to speak for himself, Roxana, is a pretty hardworking journalist and someone who I don't think left Iraq on a whim. He was there through some pretty tough times, and I watched him actually encouraging his reporters to go back into the street when there were death threats against them. However, Roxana, I like the point that you have raised, and I would like to pick that up when we come back after the break, because I think this whole idea about how you introduce democracy is key. I mean, we look at those communist countries, which all of them began to taste democracy back in the late 80s, and in many cases, 15 years later, are nowhere closer to the kind of democracy that they were dreaming of back then. Does that mean Iraq's going to take 15 years? Think about that. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. And with me in the studio, Zainab Al-Suwaij. She is Executive Director of the American Islamic Congress, born in Basra, Iraq, left after the Gulf War, after the failed 1991 uprising against Saddam Hussein, came to the United States, completed her studies here, and is just back from a 10-month stint in Iraq working on civil structure in that country. And that's what we're talking about this hour, whether or not you can introduce notions of democracy to a generation of people, two generations of people who've grown up with none. We go back to what Roxana was saying. She comes from a communist country. I'm wondering whether or not it's unrealistic to expect that anything should change so quickly after the capture of Saddam Hussein.
Of course, this is something that needs a while until things take its place back. The second thing, there is a lot of initiative towards training people about democracy, training women, training youth, and training the whole country, right? Basically, that's what needs to be done. There are many American organizations that, and also the American government that is pushing for having democracy project or programs training running in Iraq right now in many different parts of the country.
But Zainab, I mean, in many ways, none of it matters if the Iraqi police will will run away as soon as somebody shows up with a hood on their head. None of it's going to matter if the Iraqi police won't pick up their guns and say, yeah, we will protect them.
Well, don't forget, the Iraqi police, they do have limited authority back there. They are not giving all authority to go back and fight. That's, I ask many Iraqi police member why you're not, for example, stopping these thugs from taking, like, stealing cars or people or travelers between, for example, Baghdad and Jordan. They said we only have a certain authority, or limited authority, in fact, and we don't have a full authority to stop them. We have like certain amount of bullets that they give to us every week, and this is cannot do much to protect. And if they give us the full authority,
we're back to the same argument that we were in before. They won't give us authority, or they won't take authority.
That's right. If they give us more authority, then it will be we will do much more.
Let's go to line to Somerville, Massachusetts, and Dan's joining us on the line. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that it seems like a bit of a stretch to think that democracy can be imposed upon a people. Doesn't it need to sort of grow from the grassroots and kind of grow organically through a number of years? I mean, we're talking decades and decades and decades. Before a population can really be ready for it and can really understand what it means to live in a democratic society.
So the question, Dan, is if you just scatter the seeds, are you leaving too early?
Not just scattering the seeds, but I think what I'm saying is that it just a population needs to be ready for democracy through its own growth, through time as it evolves. And can you really just tell a group of people that you're a democracy and here's what you do in a democracy and here's what it means to be in a democracy without them sort of coming to that realization themselves?
So the idea being then, Dan, that the United States might in fact have to stay in Iraq a lot longer while some of those ideas grow organically in the country?
Exactly.
I think what you're saying, that we should have the U.S. Staying longer inside Iraq to have democracy implemented inside the country, is one of the ideas that many people are thinking of, that America should stay longer to have things settle down, to have people, to help people understand what about, not only about democracy and civil society, minority rights, all of these issues that has been it's been there in the field, and people need to know more about. So running these projects and training programs to people, I think, will be very valid, and it's very much needed inside Iraq.
Do you think, Dan, that there is that kind of patience in this country for that level of involvement while democracy takes root?
I don't know, because it isn't something that they've come to on their own. In this country, it was something that we realized on our own. There was a history of it from England, and we came over here, and then over the course of, well over a century, we realized that we wanted liberty from England. Mm-hmm. And again, nobody said to us, okay, you're going to have freedom. It was just eventually we evolved, and eventually we matured to that point. And I think when you have an occupying force trying to tell these people to evolve and trying to tell these people to mature to that point, I don't know if it can work.
I think it's a nice way of moving that one step further, Zainab. As long as you have an occupying force that is inside its Bradley fighting vehicles and its tanks and nervous about rocket-propelled grenades and bombs at all times, then you're going to have this conflict that's underway between the American soldiers and the Iraqi insurgents.
That's right.
And what happens, or what can happen, is exactly what happened in a place like Fallujah, where a group of people desecrated the bodies of some Americans, got a lot of play here. the Americans responded with what we now understand is an attack or a sweep through Fallujah, mm-hmm. which may have killed as many as 700 Iraqis. Mm-hmm. And that is played and replayed every day on Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya television.
Right. That's right.
And that's how those people are seeing the occupation. I'm thinking, you know, there's two roads here. And one of them is that the military mess just gets worse and worse and worse. Nobody's looking down this road of, you know, growing democracy and civility.
That's right. There are so many countries around Iraq or in the region that don't mean well for Iraq. And certainly when they run these tapes on TV, so many people, I spoke with many, many Iraqis inside Iraq, and doing that to a dead person is a horrible thing. They condemn these things. They did not accept it. And even on the religious point of religion point of view, is not acceptable in our religion to do such a thing.
I think people here understand that. I just think that it's reached a sort of level of perhaps spiraling into a much larger military conflict
than what it should be. Yes, unfortunately. That's what happened in the past 2 weeks or so, and that doesn't mean all Iraqis or the whole country is in this in the situation of being whether this or that. Is the picture is much more bigger than that, than what you see it on TV or only the reaction of certain group mm-hmm. of people. And it's a very tough situation right now. It's not an easy to have uncertainty. And we are as people, it's very difficult for us to have uncertainty about our future or our life. So that's what also accelerates such a thing.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take another call from Drake at Massachusetts, and Malai is with us. Hi, Malai.
Hi, how are you doing, Jake?
Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. My comment is about the communication. The PR relations by the United States in Iraq has been very, very vague. Here in the United States, we've been told that the war is for liberation of Iraq, and then it has become the fighting Arab nationals who have infiltrated into Iraq, foreigners mm-hmm. who have entered into Iraq, are making up all these small groups and causing terrorism there. Now, to the Iraq people, whose original aim was to preach their democracy, to make sure they get the country back and into their governorship and move forward, they're seeing people being killed and they're being told the enemy's there. They do not see the enemy, mm-hmm. and there's no identification of the enemy.
Right.
And then when you look, for example, in the Guardian this morning, the Guardian from England says that there have been fundamental errors in the military situation in Iraq, whereby the language they have used very much is no longer about liberation or democracy. It's about occupation, which comes off a picture more similar to Israel and Palestine. Kind of, it makes everything vague that the PR relation there has totally broken down.
I wonder,
total miscommunication.
I wonder, Malai, if you haven't put your finger on what really is in many ways going to be the devilish point of trying to untangle that, and that is that the U.S. military, the U.S. military is in there making sure that its own people are safe. And so the U.S. military is not really anxious to involve Iraqi police, Iraqi soldiers, or Iraqi politicians in their plans for Fallujah for fear that maybe some information will leak out to the insurgents. And until there's that trust between the Iraqi people and the American occupiers, that may never change. What do you think?
That's right, Dick, because what has been happening when you follow the whole thing is that there's been total breakdown in communication, I think, between the military and the police. For example, in Fallujah, when al-Sadr's forces kind of broke up and began fighting there, the police disappeared. Nobody talked about the police. Where did it go? Where was it the American military was up front? Where was the police to get the whole place down? There's been thousands of police trained in Iraq. What happened to them?
Zainab, what happened to that hope for trust between the two sides? Because I think Malai's right. It's not there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, as I said, the police that I was not there, but what I heard that many of the police members, they just run away, basically, or they did not show up. Because they have a certain or a limited authority, and they do have a limited power to use. They don't have the full power that they can that they can stop such a turmoil in this region or in this area. So if they have more power, that they can, I think they can do much more than that.
When you were back in Iraq, you had a chance to go back to the city where you were born, to Basra. It was the first time in, what, 15, 16 years?
13 years.
13 years. What was it like for you to stand there in Basra and imagine a country without Saddam Hussein and what it might become?
It was great. For some reason, I felt the city is smaller than what it used to be.
That's what growing up does to you.
And it was great to go back and see my old friends and family members. I just entered my house, and they didn't know that I was there. And everyone started to cry, and the whole neighborhood, all the neighbors came around, and it was a big welcoming day. And of course, I was coming back with a lot of hopes and with a lot of things that I'm trying to help my people back there.
Can I ask you now, though, having come back to the United States and having heard the people who go, this is a mess, we should go home, it's not working, mm-hmm. there's no trust, there's no future there, are you at all a little bit more worried today about what might actually become of Iraq?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm optimistic that Iraq is going to be one of the... one of the best democratic system inside the Middle East back there. And yes, it needs a lot of sacrifice, needs a lot of patience, and needs a lot of work as well. I'm hoping that will happen sometime soon. And I hope that both Iraqis and the coalition force will put their work together.
Do you worry, that the patience won't be there, that the enthusiasm in this country won't be there?
Yeah, might the patience not be there? So many things might happen inside the country, but still, people are hopeful, and we hope that for the best of the Iraqi people and the country.
Thank you again for coming in.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Zainab Al-Sawaj is Executive Director of the American Islamic Congress. And earlier in the program, we talked with Hassan Fatah, former editor of Iraq Today. I shouldn't say former editor of Iraq Today. I think he has plans to start his paper again at some time. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.